California as a student to learn more about the B-17 aircraft because that's where they were being made. Then I was sent to Lincoln, Nebraska for an assignment and was chosen as a flight engineer on a B-17 crew at that time. We went as a bomb group to Alexandria Army Air Base in Alexandria, Louisiana, and trained together, I think about 50 crews, something like that. And at that point, they sent the entire group to Drew Air Base in Tampa, Florida. During that period in Alexandria, Hitler collapsed in Europe, and it looked like our group was going to be headed for the Pacific once again. However, they decided that they would send us home for a two-week leave and then report back to Tampa. And when I got back, the whole group had been busted up. I never saw any of my B-17 crew again. And I was assigned as a assistant line chief training French air cadets or working on AT-6 aircraft in Moultrie, Georgia. I didn't know it at the time, but of course authorities felt that the war was about over, so I suppose that's what happened, that they broke up our group. But from there, after a few weeks of doing that, they sent me to Wright-Patterson for discharge, and I got home on November 30th, 1945. So that pretty much sums up my 3 years and 2 months and 15 days.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Well, when you went Toledo, Ohio to Camp Crowder, you
yes.
were in teletype maintenance and installer.
Yes.
What exactly does that mean, teletype maintenance?
I don't know whether they even use teletype machines anymore. Western Union, are you familiar
mm-hmm.
with that? They use teletype machines, which is an electric typewriter, to send messages all across the country and around the world. And these machines were also being used by the Signal Corps in combat situations to send messages from one Army unit to another. I was trained to learn how to maintain those machines and to install them in a combat area and so forth. So that was my training at that time.
Okay, and that took how long in that training over in Missouri?
I would think about 3 months. I don't recall exactly, but it's about that.
And then from there, from Camp Crowder, you went to New Orleans in the Signal Corps. That was the same area that you were doing?
That was the same, what they call MOS. That was my designation as an installer, teletype installer, and I went to New Orleans to join a signal company, which would be an operating unit, as that maintenance man.
Okay, was that in anticipation of actually being shipped overseas?
Yes, as I said a little bit earlier, we were assigned, it looked like we were going to the South Pacific. There were several companies being alerted. And that's why he sent me to learn those two weapons in preparation for that duty. That never happened. When I came back, we had been taken off of alert, and another company went in our place. And an interesting sideline to that is that after I left that signal company to join the Army Air Corps, to follow another line of work, I received letters from friends that were in that company with me, and they did make it to the South Pacific. So if I'd stayed with them, I would have been able to do that, but nobody knew that at the time. But they went to the South Pacific in, oh gosh, I would say that has to be in early 1943 or late 1942. No, early 43.
Did you keep in contact with them while they were over there in combat? Were you able to?
I had one or two letters, yes. But generally not very much, no, because I lost track of them. I guess that's the answer to that question.
Yeah. Were you disappointed you weren't able to go over there?
Yes.
Or were you relieved?
Yeah, no. We were you somehow get the feeling that you look forward to those things. And after all, that's why you trained.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, that was disappointing. And that's one of the reasons I did what I did. I took the test and transferred to the Air Corps because nothing was happening.
Yeah.
We were just spending day after day running the obstacle course and doing other things that were, in my opinion, not very meaningful. Okay.
Okay, well then you went to the Army Air Corps classification in Burbank, California.
Right.
That's where you got into the airplane and engineer mechanic.
Yes.
Tell me a little more about that.
I had qualified for that at Amarillo Army Air Base, and had already received my certification as an aircraft and engine maintenance man. When I was sent back to Los Angeles, I was sent back there to go to school at Lockheed, right at the factory where they were making these planes. And I went to school during the daytime and then worked in the factory on the second shift making airplanes. It was a wartime armament plant. From there, I went then to Lincoln, Nebraska for assignment to a bomb crew.
Now, was this bomb crew, was that also in anticipation for going overseas?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. We were talking about assignment to a B-17 bomber group as a flight engineer, and that's where I met my crew, two pilots, navigator, bombardier, and myself, and then I had an armorer, a ball turret gunner, and a tail gunner. We didn't have any waist gunners at that point, but we went there from there to Alexandria, Louisiana, and trained for several months as a bomb group. And then they sent us down to Tampa, Florida, and I think I might have explained that during that period, the war in Europe ended, so it looked like this bomb group was going to be going to the Pacific, which again was something we had hoped for. And
so why did they, I'm a little confused on that, the war in Germany was ending and yet they were still sending troops to the Pacific,
oh,
why
absolutely.
Was that?
Because the Japanese war was still going on.
Okay.
The European war ended in the spring of 1945,
mm-hmm.
and the Japanese war did not end, which made the end of World War II, September of 1945, so there's a bracket of several months in there.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing was, one of the groups that had trained with us at Alexandria did go to Europe. They were a month ahead of us, so they got to Europe and flew as many as 10 missions before the European war collapsed. But none of us that did not go to Europe and was anticipating going to the Pacific ever really made it, because the war was, they were getting ready to drop the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, when they sent us all home on a 2-week leave in August of 1945, I was home in Toledo, Ohio on a leave when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, which effectively ended World War II.
Mm-hmm.
That's why when I got back, as I stated earlier, my crew was all gone. I never saw any of them again. And here's a bomb group of 25 or 30 airplanes, each of them with 8 or 10 crew members on, all good friends that I never saw again. They were all gone. Everybody got another assignment, and my assignment was to Moultrie, Georgia, which effectively ended my training.
How long were you in training for the B-17 crew?
Probably 4 months.
4 months?
Mm-hmm.
And you were in training every day for that?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we flew 6 to 10 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. Why didn't they ever send you over any earlier?
Well, the war, in the eyes of those that knew the war was coming to an end, they didn't need us. That's what we were told. It was a great day when it ended, and I had a wife and a little girl at home, so it was nice to go home.
When did you met Grandma in Toledo before you joined?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Knew her in high school. Classic high school romance story.
And then you joined before or after you guys got married?
Before. We were not married until... We were married, actually, when I was stationed at Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas. She flew in down there for the Christmas holidays. We were married. She stayed through the New Year's holidays and went home.
So she stayed in Toledo while you were going around
doing all that. I never saw her again until I was at Amarillo training to become an aircraft mechanic. And of course that preceded the assignment to a bomb group. It's all listed there.
Yeah. Explain to me more about your job as a mechanic. I mean, what were you in charge of?
When you are a flight engineer on a bomber, you have the authority to tell whether or not that aircraft's going to fly or not. I had to inspect the aircraft before it went up. It was my job, and I had that experience, to tell the pilots to land it if something wasn't going right. I had certain duties on board, transferring fuel from wing tanks and bomb tanks and so forth to keep the engines running. I had to monitor all the instruments and so forth. And I kept charts and records on performance of all the engines. But the flight engineer can tell the pilot to shut an engine down if he feels it's not running properly, and that happened to me in one of these training missions.
Tell me about that.
We lost oil pressure on number 3, which is the right inboard engine, and you have possibly a minute to a minute and a half to feather the propellers. In other words, you turn them into the wind so that as you're flying, they do not windmill and vibrate the aircraft. You have about a minute to do that because it's done with oil pressure. And the oil pressure had begun to fall off. So we were 20,000, 25,000 feet on oxygen, and I just simply indicated that he should kill that engine. He agrees. He can overrule me, but they don't generally. We feathered that engine, and by that time we were somewhere up in Kentucky, I think, on a bombing mission. And lo and behold, number four on the same side, fuel pressure went bad, and so we killed that engine. So we're flying on two, and they instructed us over the radio to land at a naval air station in Mississippi on our way back to Louisiana. And as we were approaching, they cleared all the aircraft out of the area because we had the straight-in approach. And I managed to get number four running again. I pumped some fuel from the bomb bay tanks and just a little. I think that engine probably was low on fuel. So we got it going again. We came in on three. And the next day, some senior mechanics, some mechanics senior to me, took that number three apart and found brass filings and chips in the oil. That's what had killed it. The filter came apart. So it was an aircraft engine failure. So that was an interesting experience.
Well, the air filter falling apart, would
the
that have been
oil
under,
filter.
Or the
sorry.
Oil filter.
Yeah.
The oil filter falling apart, would that have been in your department as far as?
That's something you can't foresee. It was functioning fine for 2 or 3 hours, and all of a sudden it went bad.
Oh, my goodness.
It's a brass filter built into the aircraft engine.
And just from it shedding and putting fillings in the oil,
plugs up the oil pressure.
How hard would it have been to land with just two engines on the same side?
We were doing fine. Okay. What they did, it was a naval air station, so they I can remember hearing them on the radio clearing all aircraft out of the way and giving us a straight-in approach. We were trimmed, the aircraft was trimmed and flying straight and level. It just slows you down. You can't maintain the speed that you need. But we were coming on in, and then we got number four started, so we came in on three engines. And they had the fire engines out, but we didn't need them.
How'd you get number four started again?
Pumping some more fuel back into the wing tanks for that particular engine, and it seemed to do the trick. So.
Do you have to hand pump it?
No, an electric switch, which you turn on with and use your wristwatch to time the volume of fuel that goes into that tank. It's something you're trained to do.
Mm.
So many gallons per minute.
And that was your job up there.
It sounds a lot more dramatic than it was, but it there it was. So.
Well, those were big crafts, you know.
Well, by today's standards, not so big. It was a 20-ton aircraft. That was another one of my jobs, to learn the loading factors of it. But I never got to use it because the only bombs we carried in training were 100-pound practice bombs. But in combat, you're flying with 500-pound bombs. So, anyhow, that's another part of the training regimen. But where were we going with that? Anyhow, it was. I liked that work very much. I really did. And
what did you like better about that than the other jobs?
Oh my gosh, it's a lot more romantic and a lot more thrilling, and I like to fly. And we had a good crew.
Who was
I think we would have succeeded.
Who was on your crew?
Well, my pilot was a young fellow by the name of Leroy Gotcher from California. Looked like a movie star. Pink cheeks, dark curly hair, and he was only 19 years old. And he could fly that airplane very well. So we got along great. Yeah. I had a co-pilot that I didn't have a whole lot of confidence in, but...
Who was he?
I don't remember his name.
Let's see, what other crew was on there? You had your ball turret gunner.
Well, there was a radio operator. In the order of ranking, after the four commissioned officers, the two pilots, the navigator, the bombardier, and myself. Then I had a radio operator. We had an armorer whose responsibility it was to load the bombs in the plane and arm them, make sure they're ready to go. Then we had a ball turret gunner who was about your size.
That's kind of small.
Little fella. Well, there wasn't much room in the ball turret.
Probably be the job Rob would have.
And, yeah, he'd be perfect for that because you can't get a guy with who's over 6 feet tall in those turrets. They just can't fit in there.
Who was your ball turret gunner? What was his name?
I wish I'd known you were going to ask me that. I have their pictures and I have their names. He was from Kentucky.
We can get that when we get back home.
Yeah. Then we had a tail gunner. Now, the ball turret gunner was a nice kid. Beautiful smile. Gets sick as a goat every time we go up. Just couldn't take it. I don't know whether he would have survived or not. So many times, or a few times, our armorer would get down in the ball and fire off his rounds for him because he was just plain sick, throwing up in a bucket. But we were all kids. I was the oldest guy on the crew. I was 22 or 23. So it was a very exciting time for me. And if I'd have had any sense, having an aircraft and engine certification, I would have gone right to United Airlines or somebody after the war and gone to work there. Because, but who knows, you know.
Which was your favorite assignment?
The flight engineer. That was the best.
Was there a particular place you liked being stationed in as you were flight engineer? Or
no, I had no knowledge of that. It's a camaraderie that you develop with the people you're flying with. I might mention to you something a little bit unusual or funny. When we lost those engines and then finally came in on three in Mississippi, here's seven guys on board, and we had enough money between all of us to buy a bar of soap, a razor, some shaving soap, and a couple of washcloths. We thought we were going to be back home at the end of the day, but of course we didn't land back home again. So that was kind of funny. We joked about that quite a bit. We shared the razor and the bar of soap to take a shower.
So you got stuck in Mississippi?
For 2 days. And I might mention at that point that your grandmother was living with me in Alexandria, Louisiana. So when I left that morning to go to work, I knew that I was going to go on a bomb run, but I didn't know where. And I didn't know I wasn't coming back. And she got word from a friend of mine who also had a mishap on that run, but he got home the same day. And he told her what had happened to us, because they know by radio where you are. But anyhow, She knew I was safe. And they sent a plane in from Alexandria to Mississippi and picked us up and took us back home.
Do you even know where in Mississippi you guys landed
at? If I had a map, I could tell you, and I could rattle it off. Now I just can't think of it. It was a very well-known naval air station.
Oh, so you were able to have bunks and...
Oh, yeah, they put us up, fed us, and so forth, but I just didn't have a razor, and I didn't have, which I haven't had today yet, but anyhow, that's the sum and substance of my 3 years.
Do you have any other memorable runs that you guys did, or were they all pretty...
Oh, they were all pretty... I can tell you one other funny thing, I guess you could call it. When we were in Tampa, the commander of this air base here in Tampa insisted that we fly for 6 hours, that we dare not, our wheels were not allowed to touch the runway coming down until we were up 6 hours. Which is one of his hang-ups. And we went out to drop some bombs. I can't remember when anymore. I suspect it might have been right about Fort DeSoto, where I was later camping years later. One bomb wouldn't let go. We couldn't get it to drop. So we were out over the Gulf of Mexico. Pilot flew out over the Gulf because we wanted to get rid of it. You did not dare come back with a bomb in the bomb bay. That was against the rules. So my armor got down in the ball turret and tipped the two 50 caliber machine guns downward. And a couple of us went into the bomb bay and kicked that bomb out, and it released, and it went down, and he tried to shoot it going down, which was pretty stupid because he missed it, fortunately, and we laughed about that quite a bit, but we had to get rid of it, and that was the way we did it.
So it's somewhere in the Gulf of Mexico?
It's in the Gulf of Mexico.
Now these... When you made these practice runs and you were dropping bombs,
yes.
They were practice bombs.
Yes, what 100 pounds, what they call smoke bombs.
So they would detonate on impact and just smoke?
Yeah, you could see them from the air.
Okay, were there specific places that
there
you
were,
would run?
There were, I wasn't privy to that because that was our navigator and bombardier's responsibility, but there were target ranges in specific areas around the country where you dropped that stuff. And I was talking about specific target areas for bomb runs and so forth. One thing I left out of this, because I just forgot it, was that I did my aerial gunnery at Las Vegas, Nevada. After I finished my aircraft and engine mechanic and had not yet been assigned to a crew, I was sent to Las Vegas with lots of other people, lots of other guys in my position, to take aerial gunnery. Part of that training was standing in a pickup truck with a shotgun mounted on a pedestal and shooting at clay pigeons as you went around a track. That was to teach you to lead the target. The other part of it was each of us, and me in particular, because my combat position was the top turret with a pair of 50 caliber machine guns. Your bullets were painted different colors. Each guy had a different color. Then another plane would fly alongside of you, towing a great big target sleeve, and you shot at that target sleeve. Now he was probably 100 yards away. You know, parallel to you, the plane was ahead, but the target was right out in front. And then when they got back, they'd count the colored holes in the sleeve, and they knew who hit what and how many times. And I might mention to you that I was among the top 10 in my class and was taken to dinner at one of the hotels on the what is now the Strip. It wasn't there then. It was just a hotel. But I was very proud of that, to find my name on the bulletin board, being in the top 10 of my gunnery class. So that was fun. And when you finish that, let me see, for the aircraft and engine mechanic completion, I was allowed to wear insignia on my sleeve that looked like a gear mechanic.
They didn't call you gearheads, did they?
No. Oh, okay. For flexible gunnery and flight engineer, I could wear a pair of wings. And that's how that came about. So that pretty much sums up my less than exciting 3 years. When I began to write these things down, I realized how many places I had been. And you can readily see that you don't stay put in one place very long.
No, you don't.
In 3 years. Do you have any other thoughts?
Well, you mentioned the running around a track in a pickup truck to learn how to lead targets and shoot. What other kind of training did you have to go through to be on a B-17 bomber?
Well, the very things that I talked about, that was the gunnery practice only.
And everybody on the crew?
Yes, everybody took that. And the waist gunners naturally had to learn that, because that's where the most of the firing was done from. And of course, also during our training, we were fitted with cameras on our guns. And you had aircraft actually flying pursuit curves on you. They were attacking us. And you fired at them with your guns just as if you were in combat. And that camera took pictures. And then they showed them to you the next day on the screen and critiqued you as to how well you did. It's quite interesting when you're flying the top turret of a bomber and you're looking up with a pair of 50 caliber machine guns, and the guy flying the fighter plane is coming right straight down at you. You can look right through the windshield and see him. I can visualize that jet to this day. And of course then you see the next day how well you did. That's all part of it.
Were you already in the Air Corps learning to fly and to be an engineer when, you know, the story about the Memphis Belle and the first flight crews got over there? Was that...
That came much earlier than that.
Yeah.
You see, that's one of the reasons I feel that I never got a chance to go overseas. I came along too late. And I can't tell you the years that the Memphis Belle did there. I did know it. I don't remember it. And, but those guys had 25 missions in, as the story goes, and everybody knows it, was the first B-17 that flew 25 missions.
And that was standard? Was that your standard that they were preparing you for?
The 25 missions?
Yeah.
That was normal in those days, yeah. 25 missions and you're rotated stateside or... Now, an interesting sideline, too, and these things come to me as I go along here. When I was at Texas Tech, there were four of us in the dormitory room that I was in. One of them was a fellow who had his 25 missions in with the 5th Air Force in the South Pacific as a radio operator on a B-17. Gary was a real nice guy. He turned out, when Doris and I decided to get married, Gary was my best man, because we were married during that period. And because of his combat experience, when we went to California, they let him finish training. And I talked to Gary 1995, when I was out in Las Vegas with my motorhome, and I asked him, I knew that he had finished and gotten his pilot's wings. And I said, what kind of duty did you draw? And he said, very disgustedly. I towed targets. He towed the very targets that we were shooting at. And when I look back at the dates, he could have very well been there towing targets when I was there shooting at him. But, you know, that's all there is to that story. But he was very upset because he thought he was going to get some pretty exotic duty and he was towing targets. But see, again, the war was coming to a close. It was winding down a little bit. Not totally at that time because the European war was still going, but he didn't get the assignment he had hoped. What else do you want to know?
Well, just it's kind of interesting. It almost seems like for the 3 years that you were enlisted, you were trying to chase the war in hopes of getting over
there.
That's
a pretty good way of putting it. A lot of us were that way. I don't know of anybody who was trying to get out or to slip away from the responsibilities. I don't know of anybody. It's a camaraderie that is very exciting. It really is. And I enjoyed it. And you're young, and you don't have any fear. You know, I haven't got enough sense to have any fear. And when I think today, if somebody asked me, well, I might take a ride in a B-17 if I had a chance. They do sell rides, but I can't afford to do that now the way they price it. But it's thrilling enough that your tongue is in your cheek a little bit, you know, when you leave the ground in one of those things. So, and coming in is even more thrilling.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the tale of my 3 years, kid. Is there anything else on your mind?